Parables of the Messiah, number 25, The Strong Man Spoiled, Matthew 12, verse 22 to 30, Mark 3, verse 22 to 30, Luke 11, verse 14 to 23. A man was blind and dumb, and in the language of the first century, possessed of a demon. When Jesus healed him, the people in their amazement exclaimed, "Is not this the son of David?" That is not this the Messiah? The Pharisees, however, sought another explanation. They could not deny the miracle, but at all costs they must deny the inference that thereby his messiahship was established. They therefore said, "This fellow doth not cast out devils, but by Beelzebub, the prince of devils." It was a rash and wicked charge, and Jesus at once replied to it. He knew their thoughts, the record tells us. They had not been addressing him, and it would appear that, in fact, they were beyond his hearing. "He called them unto him," says Mark. They learned by experience of continual discomfiture that both his questions and his answers were things to dread. His answer was now simple in its form and obvious in its application. A kingdom divided against itself comes to desolation. Civil war disintegrates. It does not consolidate. And this is true also of municipal and family life. Where there is internal strife, there is weakness, and at last dissolution. If Jesus worked by satanic power in curing people supposedly under Satan's influence, then Satan was fighting against himself. The absurdity of the reasoning showing how desperate was their difficulty to explain away the miracle. But their own sons, either their own children or their disciples, practised exorcism. Did they explain the power of their sons as being of satanic origin? Obviously not. Then the possibility of other agencies in the healing of demoniacs was admitted. Then comes Christ's counterclaim. If he should have done the miracle by divine power, by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God is come unto them. The miracle could not be disputed. The amazement of the people shows how altogether different in method and result was the healing Jesus performed from the cures done by others. It was manifestly done by divine power, and by that only. Then God was working in their midst. But Jesus calls it the coming unto them of God's kingdom. His words draw a contrast with the kingdom of Satan. They also indicate that if he was doing the mighty works which will be done when God's kingdom comes, then he must be the Messiah through whom, by general Jewish consent, the prophecies were to be fulfilled. The kingdom was come nigh to them, not only in the presence of the Messiah, but also in those principles and powers upon which the kingdom will be established and maintained, as shown by the works of Jesus. The kingdoms of God and of Satan were in conflict. Thus stated, Satan is a personification of sin and its consequences, disease. Sin was, as it were, enthroned in the world, and since sin was the ultimate cause of all the evils of human life, in those evils its sway was illustrated. The kingdom of God is a kingdom of righteousness, and the effects of righteousness, quietness, assurance, and life will be the evidence of its establishment. God's kingdom will bring a worldwide extension of the ways of life seen in Jesus. But the issue was then being joined, and Jesus illustrates the conflict by a parable. or else how can one enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house? Sin was strong, but not invincible. There was a stronger than he. Who could bind him as a captive and liberate his captives? The power of Jesus to do it was shown in his removal there and then of the effects of Satan's power over the demoniac. Since the work of Jesus is thus seen to be related to the conflict of sin and righteousness in the world, men are not allowed to be neutrals. To espouse the cause of righteousness is a duty. Neutrality is a help to the enemy. This Jesus expressed in terms of personal association with himself. He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad. The Pharisees accused Jesus of alliance with Satan. His rejoinder was a warning. Jesus clearly was in opposition to Satan, since he had destroyed Satan's works. If the Pharisees were not with Jesus, they must be on Satan's side. It was a terrible counter-thrust. In a similar figure, God had said he was stronger than the Babylonian who had taken captive his people. Shall the prey be taken from the mighty, or the lawful captive delivered? But thus saith the Lord, even the captives of the mighty shall be delivered, for I will contend with him that contendeth with thee, and I will save thy children. Isaiah 49, verse 24 and 25. Israel's enemies have again and again found God to be mightier than themselves. Belshazzar's impious challenge to the truth of the predictions of God's prophets brought the nerve-shattering spectacle of the written doom on the walls of the palace. Many centuries before that day, Pharaoh vainly tried to keep his captives. But when the selfsame day of God's promised deliverance dawned, Pharaoh was glad to see the backs of his slaves. Thou hast ascended on high, thou hast led a host of captives, was the psalmist's commemoration of it in words which at the same time foretell the Lord's greater deliverance of captives from the bondage of death, as Paul witnesses in his exposition of Psalm 68 in Ephesians 4, verse 8. This deliverance from death is referred to in Isaiah 49, verse 9, where the servant of God who was given for a covenant will say to the prisoners, "Go forth, to them that are in darkness, show yourselves." He has even now acquired the key of the grave to open that prison house and call out its captives. Is the figure of the angel from heaven that binds Satan, Revelation 20, verse 2, a reminiscence of this short parable of the strong man bound and despoiled? Parables of the Messiah, number 26, The Unoccupied House. Matthew 12, verse 43 to 45, Luke 11, verse 24 to 26. It is usual to call this parable the story of the unclean spirit, but such a title puts the emphasis in the wrong place. It draws attention to the occupant, when the state of the house is the first consideration. This story, like the rich man and Lazarus, is based upon current popular beliefs, which regarded the world as the abode of unseen spirits, demons, which entered into possession of men and became the cause of their various maladies. A deaf spirit might be the cause of deafness, a dumb spirit the cause of dumbness, and so on. a demonized figure frequently among the cures of Jesus. Possession by demons is a notion that debases and bemuses thought, being destructive of the soundness of mind in which life can be faced with courage, its problems examined, and knowledge of fact secured. Moreover, it tends to shift the responsibility for life onto the demon, when it really belongs to the person. The idea, however, lends itself effectively to the lesson Jesus wanted to teach. The touch of eeriness attached to it would make it impressive. We have to think of something intangible, evil and repellent, something to be disliked. The spirit tenants a man who is the expression of the evil thing. It then leaves him and roams homeless in the wilderness. In its absence, the house is cleaned and made wholesome, but remains unoccupied. The spirit, meanwhile, is seeking rest, and bethinks itself of its old home. It creeps towards it, peeps within, and finding no occupant, rushes away to gather other boon companions to share the house with it. The one tenant which originally needed an eviction order has now become eight. And as Jesus said, the last state is worse than the first. What is the meaning of this parable? The primary application Jesus fixes for us when he added, "Even so shall it be also unto this generation." The story was at once a description and a prophecy. It described that generation at the point when the evil had gone, but was returning. Its last end was still in the future, shall be, when Jesus spoke. The meaning is not difficult to find. The nation was sinful, the more blameworthy that they had the Lord of God. Through the preaching of John there had been a cleansing process going on. The people had repented and been baptized of John, confessing their sins. But John had directed attention to the greater than himself, upon whom they should believe. Instead of doing this, they stopped short. Instead of belief, active opposition to God's will as revealed in Jesus was taking hold of them, presently to be shown in their rejection of him. This was followed by their refusal of the appeal through the apostles, after which the nation was given over to its self-will, which reached its climax in the frenzied resistance to Rome, when the fury and perversity of fanaticism demonized the nation and swept it to its own destruction. Jesus had spoken of that generation as evil and adulterous, verse 39. They had asked for a sign, but the only sign they were given was one already before them in the Scriptures, the sign of the resurrected prophet whose preaching was heard by Gentile Ninevites. The men of Nineveh condemned that generation, as also did the Queen of Sheba who sought Solomon for his wisdom, for one greater than either Jonah or Solomon was there, sent of God and revealing God's wisdom. But that generation would not give heed to him. The parable was a warning of doom for their folly of not receiving Jesus as the ruler of the house. The parable is fundamentally, psychologically true of human nature. The parable is the story of many a man who has sought with some success to exorcise an evil habit, but instead of developing and enthroning the opposite positive good, has stopped short at the first step. Nature will not allow this. Unless a good habit is given full possession, the old evil asserts itself with sevenfold power, and recovery becomes sevenfold more difficult. "Make free men of your pupils," counsels William James in Talks to Teachers, "by habituating them to act, whenever possible, under the notion of good. Get them habitually to tell the truth, not so much through showing them the wickedness of lying, as by arousing their enthusiasm for honour and veracity. Wean them from their native cruelty by imparting to them some of your own positive sympathy with an animal's inner springs of joy. And in the lessons, upon the bad effects of alcohol, lay less stress than the books do on the drunkard's stomach, kidneys, nerves, and social miseries, and more in the blessings of having an organism kept in lifelong possession of its youthful elasticity by a sweet, sound blood to which stimulants and narcotics are unknown, and to which the morning sun and air and dew will daily come as sufficiently powerful intoxicants. Or, in the words of another, evil appetites and passions do not yield most readily to direct assault. Passion must be evoked to cast out passion, and if once heart and mind be filled with strong positive interests, the rest will come of itself. For these wholesome incentives will, ever increasingly, occupy the soul, and if only they are skilfully fostered, will strike up alliances with one another till the promptings we wish to get rid of will gradually be ousted from their squalid or knavish tenancy. For development and repression are not two things, but one. All genuine development already carries in it repression of much. But just as the lesson of the story, being fundamentally true, has its application to the nation of Israel and to individuals, so it would be possible to trace the parallel in broader movements among men. The Reformation did something to cleanse Europe of Romish superstition, and for a time enthroned the Bible, but did not go on to a full understanding of it. Decline set in. Higher criticism found its home in the very land of the Reformation, and the nation accepted the absurdities put forward by Nazi propagandists, and their evil state revealed itself in the horrors of detention camps and all the ghastly practices which the trials of Nuremberg dragged to light. Who can exorcise the evil spirits which hold power in the soul of a nation?